This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As the U.S. prepares to launch a massive assault on Iraq, people in that country are preparing for the worst. Independent radio producer Jeremy Scahill has been filing reports from inside Iraq for the past several weeks. His daily reports are heard on the national radio program Democracy Now!, as well as on his website, iraqjournal.org. Today, he files this report from the southern city of Basra, an area of Iraq that has been worst hit under U.S. bombing and sanctions since the end of the Gulf War.
For hundreds of years, Basra was called the Venice of the East. Sinbad the Sailor's adventures were launched from its shores. The city is connected by a web of footbridges and canals that empty into the Shatt al-Arab, a focal point of the Arab sea trade for more than 1,300 years. It endured both Ottoman and British occupation. Fishermen and boats line the boardwalk that houses 101 towering individual bronze statues. Each one is unique and modeled after an Iraqi army soldier killed during the Iran-Iraq War. They stretch down the boardwalk for a mile, all of them with their arms raised, fingers pointing accusingly toward the Iranian border, some 6 miles to the east. The statues serve as a haunting reminder that Basra has long ceased to be thought of as anyone's Venice. Basra has been one of the most fought-over areas in the world. It's a stone's throw from both Iran and Kuwait, and suffered tremendously during both the Iran-Iraq War and the Gulf War. Basra is the heart of Iraq's oil belt, one of the richest stretches of land on earth, but its nearly 2 million residents see almost no benefit from Basra's black gold. The poor Jumeirah neighborhood is full of roads overflowing with raw sewage and garbage. The streets are packed with children playing among the trash and green pools of waste. The whole area reeks of excrement. Here lives the family of Abu Muhammad. He's worked throughout his adult life as an oil mechanic, servicing the country's vast oil industry. Yet the meager salary that he earns from his work barely allows him to feed his family of eight, including his 2 children with Down syndrome. Only one of the children can attend school, and the family lives in a rat-infested, decrepit hovel that can only be described as a cave. Apart from a ceiling fan and a broken TV, they have no electrical appliances. They recently sold their refrigerator and electric cooker to repair a wall that had crumbled. Abu Muhammad is a proud and dignified man. He sits on the cement floor in his home, stroking the head of Haider, his teenage son with Down syndrome, and he talks about Washington's threats to invade Iraq.
We don't accept any invaders. I belong to a tribe, and no matter what happens, I will defend them. Do the Americans think that by coming here they will have a picnic in Iraq? Even if an Iraqi has something wrong with his government and the land is invaded from abroad, he will defend it. The core of the problem is that somebody wants to take your home.
Abu Muhammad's wife interrupts.
This house is poor and destroyed, but it is very dear to us. We will defend it and we will not give it to anybody.
Across the street from the family of Abu Muhammad lives another family that survives on the outskirts of Iraq's oil industry. Majid and Karima and their 4 children live in a 2-room shack. Majid is a struggling artist, and their home is filled with his paintings of Imam Ali, one of the holiest figures in Shiite Islam. Majid walks with a limp. During the Gulf War, he was driving in a carpool to the factory where he was working when a missile hit the road in front of them. 3 of his co-workers were killed, while Majid and 6 others sustained injuries. He shows us his leg, left disfigured by the attack. Like almost everyone in Basra, Majid and Karima do not speak about war in the future tense. They live within the so-called no-fly zones imposed by the U.S. and Britain, allegedly to protect Shiite Muslims like them from Saddam. But Majid and Karima say they do not feel safer because of America's missiles. Like most families here, they sleep outside in a fly-infested courtyard on rotting mattresses near their outhouse. At night, they hear the thunder of Washington's planes. Majid says when they hear the roar of the planes, he feels powerless to help his wife, who says she collapses when they come.
I feel sick when I hear the planes flying above. I cry. I have psychological shock. I can't sleep. I listen to the radio and I feel scared. We are asking God just to save us.
Majid
In Washington, George W. Bush speaks of his love for the Iraqi people, saying he has no quarrel with them. But Karima and Majid wonder if Bush ever considers their children, robbed of their childhood by 12 years of war and sanctions. Across the street, Abu Mohammed says he doesn't talk to his children about what may lie ahead.
What am I supposed to tell them? That there'll be a war and you'll be dead?
All over Iraq, people speak of defending the country against an American invasion. But nowhere did this ring more true than when we spent time in the home of Abu Mohammed, his wife and their six children, in the poor Jumeirah neighborhood in the port city of Basra. For now, they continue the daily struggle to make ends meet, knowing that someday in the not-too-distant future, they may have to defend their poor, destroyed home from foreign invaders. This is Jeremy Scahill in Basra.
Jeremy Scahill reports along with video footage from film producer Jackie Sowen can be viewed at www.iraqjournal.org. Another person who's visited Basra recently is Kathy Kelly, leader of the Chicago-based organization Voices in the Wilderness. We reached her in a Baghdad hotel room earlier today and asked her to describe her recent travels and the formation of the Iraq Peace Team.
You know, when we were down in Basra just days ago, there was an effort in a very poor neighborhood that we stay in to start to put in just some curbs that might help with the sewage that spills over into the houses and begin just an initial semblance of an infrastructure on their streets. And when you think about the huge resources being poured now into building up an infrastructure for the U.S. military, making sure that the troops that would arrive here would have adequate water and adequate sewage and sanitation and plenty of electricity, and then all of the money that goes into the ammunition and the targeting and the delivery. And then you see the pitiful efforts at just the rudiments of an infrastructure that could now get beaten back down into the ground again. It's a terrible and really a grotesque contrast. So we want to have a peace build up, and certainly in comparison to the staggering U.S. military build up and the inflated threats and, I think, generation of hatred that often comes with preparation for war, that there needs to be a more realistic assessment of what's happening in this country. I don't think that there are people in Iraq that we've met who harbor great hatred or would ever want to attack people in the United States.
I asked you earlier why you're there. Are you there to, we've heard reports that you're there to act as a human shield. Is that an over-exaggeration of what your purpose is there?
Well, we've never used that word. You know, journalists aren't regarded as human shields here, and they try very hard to get out a story. And we're basically doing the same. It's just that our story, I think, tries to present the realities of some people that we don't think the U.S. media has adequately covered. So no, we don't at all regard ourselves as human shields, but rather we're here to accompany people during an extraordinarily tense time and to say that we're going to try to take the same risks that they take, but all the way through that process we'll be writing and through radio interviews and through whatever kind of media we can send back, building up greater and more intense awareness of the average situation for ordinary families here. We'll also go to the places that we think are quite crucial, places like sewage and sanitation facilities and electrical facilities and bridges and all of these places were bombed, in fact, within the first 3 days of the Gulf War in 1991. So we'll hold vigils there, but right now, until the resolution passes, we've been out in front of the United Nations every day. And we still think that the United Nations, founded to eliminate the scourge of warfare, has a big role to play here, and that people in the United Nations have a responsibility to speak up. We know they would take a risk, but we've taken somewhat of a risk to be here ourselves. And that we are definitely calling on every person working within a government structure or the United Nations or religious leaders to heighten their risk-taking right now, to try to oppose a war that will be catastrophic for civilians here and could have untold catastrophic consequences, and also to try to help U.S. people realize that every war in which the United States has been involved has always involved a spiraling cost that has never been spiraled downward. This will just increase the amount of money and needed resources in the United States that will get poured into what I can only call right now the rat hole of military spending.
Mm-hmm. How many members of your group are there, Kathy?
Well, we're 12 right now. And we really do have many applications in Chicago, and we encourage more people to think of forming support groups now and exploring whether or not in the future they might want to consider joining us. We're looking for seasoned, nonviolent peace activists mm-hmm. who would be able to handle a situation of a great deal of uncertainty and some flexibility, but also build up within their own area support groups that would include media outreach and outreach to religious leaders and community leaders.
So, Kathy, let me ask you this. So your group is planning to remain there once the U.S. military attacks began?
Yes, that's right. I would think that that's where we should be. We've tried now since 1996 as Voices in the Wilderness to be voices for people here, and I think it would be a terrible time to say, well, now the going's getting rough, we're going to clear out. We want to say, no, fill the hotels.
Mm-hmm. And so do you make your presence highly visible in hopes that the U.S. will not bomb or target certain areas, or how do you go about making the most of your presence there?
Well, again, I think the most that we can make of our presence is in trying to communicate back to people in the United States what the realities are for children, for families, for doctors, for everyday workers who are just trying to get by with enough funds to feed their families. I'm aware that one colonel told a journalist that if they knew for certain that Americans were in one particular spot, they have 1,000 targets to hit, and they might choose one of the other targets to hit on that particular day. But I don't think that there will be any possibility that they would really call off an attack on a particular building in the odd chance that one of us might be near there. So we are telling people that this is a very risky thing to do. We're very, very serious that we want to be a presence in this country which says that our lives aren't any more valuable mm-hmm. than the lives of the people that we've met here and people who've only welcomed us with incredible hospitality and generosity. Never since the imposition of these economic sanctions have U.S. people been appraised of who pays the cost, of who pays the penalty. And I think if they knew, the economic sanctions wouldn't have withstood the light of day. I don't think the average person wants to punish children to death. Most countries have a much better awareness of exactly how lethal and brutal the punishment of ordinary civilians in this country has been. I mean, think of it. In 1999, on the day when Carol Bellamy of UNICEF, the head of UNICEF, called a press conference to say that there were an excess number of deaths amounting to 50,000 per year of children under age 5, which, when we do the math back then, came out to 500,000 deaths of children under age 5. This was announced by a UNICEF head at a press conference. Do you know how much coverage there was in the U.S. print media of that? One half of one sentence in the Wall Street Journal. You could consult LexisNexis. You can search all through the U.S. media. That's the amount of coverage which that appalling fact garnered. So, to my mind, we're always catching up, trying to get the U.S. public to become much more aware of what the United States has done in a warlike fashion to ordinary civilians in this country since 1991. And now we're amassing this huge firing squad that will pump money into the expert think tanks' offices. It'll pump money into the defense companies. It'll pump money into the weapon designers. There are so many people that will be war profiteers as this infrastructure of the military expansion develops. And very, very few people who benefit from it are going to be troubled, I think, for even one second over the families in Jumria and Basra, just to name one neighborhood, who live amidst raw sewage, who face the colder months without even the ability to plug in a space heater to warm them up, and who mainly right now shiver in fear. I've met with women who experience what they call psychological collapse when they hear the warplanes flying overhead now just because of the memories that it triggers from 1991. These people are frightened. They're like deers caught in headlights. And when will the United States people ever be aware of that?
Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. Another group founded in response to the Bush administration's agenda to launch war against the people of Iraq is outraged over the blackout of news coverage around the burgeoning anti-war movement in the U.S. Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace, believes the peace movement is being muzzled by the mainstream corporate media, and they've launched a media accountability campaign to express their anger. Smith names the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, National Public Radio, and others as guilty of underreporting recent peace demonstrations.
Well, there are two aspects to this campaign. On the one hand, we are addressing the general reporting that the media has not been doing or not been doing adequately in terms of the general anti-war movement. At the same time, we're talking about the virtual no reporting that has taken place of the involvement of blacks and other people of color within the anti-war movement. In the case of the Washington Post, New York Times, and all of them, they have not reported accurately on some of the anti-war protests that have taken place. And for example, when 30,000 people showed up in Central Park with Ed Asner, Susan Sarandon, and other celebrities, there was very little reporting in both of those newspapers. In the case of the New York Times, it appeared in the Metro section of the paper, undercounting the number of people who were there, and a very scant mention of that protest in the Washington Post. Very few of the activities sponsored by Black Voices for Peace have been mentioned in the Washington Post or the New York Times or the other mainstream media. So when it comes to estimating crowd numbers, for example, the New York Times, the first day after the march, where 100 plus thousand people came to Washington, D.C., they said that the organizers were disappointed in the turnout. They came back a few days later and reported more accurately on the state of the peace movement, but that one article did so much damage in terms of the public perception of what the peace movement is all about.
Mm-hmm. You're not suggesting that they're deliberately undercounting, are you?
I am suggesting that because the unofficial reports by the U.S. Park Police the day of the march and after was that there were at least 100,000 people at the march just a few weeks ago. So it's very clear that the mainstream media is marching lockstep with the Bush administration in trying to marginalize the nature and character and volume of the U.S. peace movement. They don't want the American people to know that there are thousands of people around the country who are opposed to this war. They did not report, for example, on the numerous anti-war activities taking place in numerous cities around the country. So while on the one hand, the Washington Post did indeed have a Metro section piece with a photo on the A section about the march a few weeks ago, they reported nothing about all of the other protests taking place around the country.
I'll have to admit, I was surprised when the Washington Post did not have a front page story about a national march of that scope, 100,000 people showing up in the nation's capital for against the war, when on the following Monday, they actually had a picture of the football team on the front page. I figured if the Redskins could make the front page, and surely 100,000 anti-war activists converging on the nation's capital would have warranted such coverage.
You're absolutely right. And I think it's important for us to really know how to analyze these situations. Some people were a little happy that the Washington Post had a photo on the front page. But this was a major news event. It deserved a photo above the fold with a story above the fold on the A section on the front page. It did not get that. So once again, the Washington Post was struggling to, they understood that it was a news event, but they just couldn't quite bring themselves to doing justice to what the story really was.
Is there a hidden agenda, do you think, on the part of editors at the Washington Post? You think there's a conspiracy? Or why would it be to their advantage not to put this legitimate story and provide professional coverage?
I think in the wake of the horrific events of September 11th last year, that the media has been doing what many people in the Bush administration has been doing, and that is to whip up the kind of public hysteria to go after the evil in the world behind terrorism. And so in this case, the evil in the world in this instance is Saddam Hussein, for example, and Iraq. And so if it means, again, underreporting the protesters in this country who are mobilizing against the war to make it seem like very few people are in opposition to the administration's policies, they would do that. If it means portraying Saddam Hussein as part of the axis of evil, glorified and magnified, then that's what they will do in the context of this war against terrorism and the deep pain and anxiety that currently exists still among many people in this country in the wake of the September 11th attacks. So they are part of the Bush administration's strategy to whip up hysteria for war, and they are moving lockstep in that direction. That is what the media is doing, and that is why we're going to protest them, not just send letters and have meetings and have phone calls taking place. We are going to visibly protest, and we're going to keep this going because the media has become part of the problem.
So you're really saying that there's some sort of surreptitious editorial tone permeating throughout all these major national newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and National Public Radio?
Absolutely. I mean, even the National Public Radio, a station that says that it is independent because it doesn't have commercials on. Well, you know, that's become very fuzzy lately because they always mention their sponsors, and it's a lot of corporate sponsors. And so when they're in that situation, they too become part of the corporate media nexus that is operating in this country in a pro-war mode. And so there indeed is, I can just, you know, if I could be a fly on the wall, I could just imagine the discussions that go on about how they're going to be dealing with major news events that are taking place. How can you, in the face of 30,000 plus people in Central Park with Susan Sarandon, a major actress in her field, Ed Asner, and other prominent celebrities, how can you put that on the Metro section? How can you say that there are 5,000 people there? You do that consciously. You do that with in mind, wanting to discredit, marginalize, underreport, with a political aim to do a disservice to the peace movement so that you can mobilize the nation towards war in support of the administration's policy. That's what this is all about.
So Adamu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace, you're pissed. And
I'm pissed.
You're saying that you're saying you're going to launch a campaign. How is that going to manifest? Are you going to be leafleting? Are you going to be pro-picketing? Or how is it going to look?
We are sending out emails throughout the country and alerts asking people to join us in this campaign. We want people to protest the media. We want people to write letters to the editor. We want people to organize meetings with editorial boards with newspapers all around the country. In other words, we cannot casually let the media get off with what they are doing. This must be a pressure campaign, just as if we were pressuring Congress or the administration or a major corporation involved in other kind of economic activity. The media is a major force in U.S. and global societies. The media frames opinions. The media is an organizing tool, and therefore we must make these people accountable, and they must know that we are out there. So we're going to protest in front of their offices, and we might even engage in some forms of civil disobedience in some instances. We are going to make this a central part of our efforts over the next several months as long as this nation is on a war footing.
The campaign against the Post begins Friday, November 15th. At a Students United for Peace rally this week in Houston, Texas, several approaches were used to communicate reasons to oppose a U.S. attack on Iraq. University of Houston student Alicia Miner spoke at the rally and shared her poem with fellow students.
I'm going to read a poem today. It's not my own. It's by a man by the name of Emmanuel Ortiz. But before I start this poem, I'd like to ask you to join me in a moment of silence in honor of those who died in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon attacks on September 11th. The silence for all those who have been harassed and imprisoned, disappeared, tortured, raped, or killed in retaliation for those strikes. For the victims in both Afghanistan and the U.S. And if I could add one more thing, a full day of silence for the tens of thousands of Palestinians who have died at the hands of the U.S.-backed Israeli forces over decades of occupation. 6 months of silence for the 1.5 million Iraqi people, mostly children, who have died of malnutrition or starvation as a result of the 11-year U.S. embargo against the country. Before I begin this poem, 2 months of silence for the blacks under apartheid in South Africa, where Homeland Security made them aliens in their own country. 9 months of silence for the dead in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where death rained down and peeled back every layer of concrete, steel, earth, and skin, and the survivors went on as if alive. 1 year of silence for the millions of dead in Vietnam, a people, not a war. For those who know a thing or two about the sin of burning fuel, their relatives' bones buried in it, their babies born of it. 1 year of silence for the dead in Cambodia and Laos, victims of a secret war. Shh, say nothing. We don't want them to learn that they are dead. 2 months of silence for the decades of dead in Colombia, whose names, like the corpses they once represented, have piled up and slipped off our tongues. Before I begin this poem, 1 hour of silence for El Salvador, 1 afternoon of silence for Nicaragua, 2 days of silence for Guatemala, none of whom ever known a moment of peace in their living gears. 45 seconds of silence for the 45 dead in Acatel, Chiapas, 25 years of silence for the 100 million Africans who found their graves far deeper in the ocean than any building could poke into the sky. There will be no DNA testing or dental records to identify their remains. And for those who were strung and swung by the heights of the sycamore trees in the south, north, east, and west, 100 years of silence. For the hundreds of millions of indigenous people from this half of right here whose lands were stolen. In postcard perfect plots like Pine Ridge, Wounded Knee, Sand Creek, Fallen Timbers, or the Trail of Tears. Names now reduced to innocuous magnetic poetry on the refrigerator of our consciousness. So you want a moment of silence? And we are left speechless. Our tongues are snatched from our mouths. Our eyes stapled shut. A moment of silence, and poets have all been laid to rest. The drums disintegrating into dust. Before I start this poem, I want a moment of silence. You mourn now as if the world will never be the same, and the rest of us pray to God that it won't be. Not like it has been, because this is not a 9/11 poem. This is a 9/10 poem, a 9/8 poem, a 9/7 poem, a 1492 poem. This poem is about what causes poems like this to be written. And if this is a 9/11 poem, then this is a September 11th poem for Chile, 1971, a September 12th poem for Stephen Biko in South Africa, 1977. This is a September 13th poem for the brothers in Attica Prison, New York, 1971. A September 14th poem for Somalia, 1992. This is a poem for every date that falls to the ground in ashes. This is a poem for the 110 stories that were never told, the 110 stories whose histories will not be in the textbooks, the 110 stories that the CNN, BBC, and the New York Times and Newsweek ignored. This is a poem for interrupting this program. You still want a moment of silence for your dead? We could give you lifetimes of empty. The unmarked graves, the lost languages, the uprooted trees and histories, dead stares on faces of nameless children. Before I start this poem, we could be silent forever or just long enough to hunger for the dust to bury us. And you still ask us for a moment of silence? Then stop the oil pumps and turn off the engines and the television, sink the cruise ships, crash the stock markets, unplug the marquee lights, delay the instant messages, derail the train, the light rail trains. If you want a moment of silence, put a brick through the window of Taco Bell and pay the workers for lost wages. Tear down the liquor stores, the townhouses, the White Houses, the jailhouses, the penthouses, and the Playboys. If you want a moment of silence, take it. Take it on Super Bowl Sunday. Take it on the 4th of July during Macy's 13-hour sale, or the next time your white guilt fills the room where my beautiful people have gathered and you want a moment of silence, then take it.
That piece was produced by Honor Brown and Chickpea with the Houston Independent Media Center. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our engineer today was Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Reem Kahuta and Jim Bennett of KPFA. I'm Verna Avery Brown, Pacifica's Peace Watch executive producer and host. Thank you for listening.